Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during our Q&A session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note today's call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the program over to Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Lindy. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being on the call. I'm Wade Henderson, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the nation's leading civil rights coalition with more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. On Wednesday, the United States Supreme Court will, for the fifth time in its history, review the Voting Rights Act, a landmark law that ensures the right to vote for millions of Americans. On that day, voters and activists will rally on the Supreme Court steps to show the court that we have more than facts and legal precedent on our side. The American people, voters, and those who are protected by the VRA are on our side as well. We invite you to learn more about this rally and events being organized throughout the South at www.protectthevra.org. At issue in the case is the heart of the law, Section 5, which protects voters in the jurisdictions with the worst history and contemporary record of discriminating against voters based on their race. Section 5 is indispensable to voters throughout the country, in Alaska, Arizona, and New York, but has more particularly been effective at protecting voters in the South, and that is the topic of today's call. Recent notable examples of Section 5 at work in the South were in the states of South Carolina and Texas, where the Justice Department blocked voter ID and redistricting laws that would have discriminated against minority voters. While these are prominent statewide examples, Section 5 protects voters in county and municipal elections every year by requiring pre-clearance of all local election changes, stopping discrimination before it can take effect. For these and other reasons that will be covered on this call, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act continues to be an indispensable tool for protecting voters and strengthening our democracy. Now, on today's call, I'm joined by Ryan Haygood, Director of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund's Political Participation Group, Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, President of the North Carolina NAACP, Calvin Henderson, a voter and NAACP president in Pitt County, North Carolina, who will tell us about how Section 5 protected his community's right to vote in 2012. And Alabama State Senator Hank Sanders, a key organizer of the 2013 Freedom Rides for Voting Rights. And now I'm honored to turn the call over to Ryan Haygood. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Wade, and thank you all for joining us on what is really an important discussion about one of the most important voting cases in a generation. As Wade mentioned, the county in Shelby County, Alabama, has challenged the heart of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and in particular, challenged whether Congress had the authority when it recently reauthorized Section 5 in 2006 to do so. The question will be before the court this Wednesday, and the question that the lawyer for the Legal Defense Fund who represents interveners, Debo Adegbole, will be asking is one, whether voting discrimination persists in covered jurisdictions such that Section 5 is still necessary, and two, whether voting discrimination is still concentrated in those places that Section 5 covers. And the answer is a very straightforward yes on both counts. In 2006, Congress took very great care to look at the places where voting discrimination was most persistent, where it was most intense, and where it was most adapted. Congress, over 10 months, held 21 hearings, heard from better than 90 witnesses, both for and against reauthorizing Section 5, and after assembling a 15,000-page record, voted in overwhelmingly bipartisan support for reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act. Concretely, Congress found that in the last reauthorization period, Section 5 served to block more than 1,000 proposed discriminatory changes that would have harmed minority voters in the all or part of 16 jurisdictions in this country that are covered. Now, much has been made about whether Congress should have updated the geographic scope of Section 5, whether the Congress should have added or subtracted some of the jurisdictions that were covered by Section 5. But here's what Congress did. Congress looked at the existing covered jurisdictions and made an empirical determination based on studies, based on testimony, that in those places, voting discrimination is of a different character, is of a more intense variety, such that court rulings in favor of minority voters were often circumvented by later efforts that came in precisely the same way the original Discriminatory Act came. But Congress looked nationwide to look at the places where voting discrimination is concentrated. There's a very important study that looks at the national provision of the Voting Rights Act, which is Section 2. Section 2 is a part of the Voting Rights Act that allows voters to challenge existing discriminatory measures. And what Congress found is that although jurisdictions covered by Section 5 only comprise 25% of America's overall population, those jurisdictions accounted for more than 80% of the successful Section 2 cases where discriminatory changes were blocked or settled on behalf of minority voters. So empirically, Congress understood in 2006 that the existing covered jurisdictions were the places where voting discrimination is most concentrated. It's for that reason that Congress stayed the course and continued to cover existing covered jurisdictions. And this is significant. The record is replete with concrete ways in which Section 5 stops proposed discriminatory changes. And I'll close with this. It may be odd to many of you that Alabama is the place from which this proposed change originates. I know it is to Senator Sanders, who will speak here shortly. And here's why. Alabama has a straight, unbroken line of racial discrimination in voting against black and later other minority voters that goes all the way back to slavery, that follows its way through emancipation and Reconstruction, the Bloody Sunday March over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which we'll celebrate in a week here, up through an important line of cases under the Diller litigation, and in Shelby County itself. There's a very important litigation called Diller litigation. Dillard was a case that impacted more than 180 jurisdictions in the state of Alabama. The court there found that for more than a century, Alabama had used intentional discrimination in the enactment of at-large voting schemes to dilute minority voting strength. As a result of settling the Diller litigation, those very 180 jurisdictions adopted non-discriminatory district-based voting schemes, including the city of Calera, which is in Shelby County. For better than 20 years on the city council under a Diller-created districting scheme, which included one majority black city council district, an African-American held that seat for 20 years until 2008, when the city of Calera, through a discriminatory redistricting plan that sought to eliminate the sole African-American district by reducing the black population from 70% to 20%, thereby causing the only African-American in the seat on the city council to lose his seat. But it turns out that the Department of Justice rejected the discriminatory redistricting plan and the election and required the city of Calera to redraw its electoral boundaries and hold another election under which black voters in this district were able to cast their ballots in a way that they reelected the African-American who lost his seat. In a very real way, Section 5 is a truth teller because it tells us both about where we are as a country, and it's informed by where we've been, and it tells us who we can be in the places where discrimination has been most intense with accountability. It tells us about where we've been to inform where we are and ultimately where we need to go. This is a very straightforward case, and the fact that the Supreme Court has four times over four decades upheld the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and that Congress did its homework when reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act with a 15,000-page record, plus the lived experiences of voters of color, the millions of voters of color in the covered jurisdictions, all point toward the Supreme Court upholding Section 5 this term when it hears Shelby County, Alabama, in just 2 days.
Thank you, Ryan. I'm now pleased to introduce Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, President of the North Carolina NAACP.
Thank you so much, Wade, and this is Reverend Barber, also Chair of the National Political Action Committee, and we have 125 branches in North Carolina that make up that state conference, and 147 members of our historic Thousands on Jones Street People's Assembly Coalition. I say that because I want to contextualize my comments in this way. Historically, every time this nation has attempted to reconstruct itself to be more in line with its noble ideals, there has been a premeditated attack on voting rights. So it was after the first year of Reconstruction in the 19th century. And it went on until African Americans were run out of office, literally run out of office, some driven out of office by riots and terrorist acts. And Jim Crow took over to nullify the promises of the 15th Amendment that no one's rights would be denied or abridged. So was the response to the Civil Rights Movement, the second Reconstruction, with the attacks against the Voting Rights Act itself even being passed, and then later the so-called Southern strategy that attempted to nullify the gains of the second Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement. And so it is now, after the 2008 elections and the new demographics and the modern fusion politics between African Americans, Hispanics, progressive whites, youth, poor people, labor, people of faith, because it's producing a new electorate and the possibility for imagining new political power and a third type of reconstruction. And this new embodiment of fusion politics frightens those with a homogeneous political worldview. And so what we have seen at the very time that the protections of the Voting Rights Act are finally bearing the political fruits of diversity and inclusion to some degree, we have seen in response to that an all-out premeditated attack on voting rights like we have not seen since the 19th century and the attempts to turn back the first Reconstruction. Premeditated redistricting, gerrymandering schemes to stack, pack, isolate, and segregate the power and potential of the black vote, but also the power and potential of the black vote to engage in fusion politics. We see them all over, and even in North Carolina and throughout the South. Now, today, they're not using so much the brute force of Jim Crow, but going in the back room with a lawyer and a computer expert and using the tactics of James Crow Esquire. That's what we're seeing today. Premeditated attacks through redistricting. In North Carolina, for instance, I will talk about that, what we have seen in here. We're also seeing premeditated attacks on voter participation through voter ID schemes designed to limit the participation of African Americans, students, and the elderly, and Latinos and other minorities. We're also seeing premeditated attacks on new election laws that provide same-day registration and early voting. And we have seen all of these premeditated attacks attempted in North Carolina or being planned. Last year, we saw this in our state. The legislature passed the most race-based redistricting plan since the 19th century. They literally stacked and packed and bleached until 52% of African Americans were isolated into 27 out of the 120 House districts in our state, and 49% of African Americans were stacked and packed and bleached until they had into 19 of our 50 Senate districts. It would have been worse. It would have been worse if there had been no protection from preclearance of Voting Rights Act. In fact, we're in court right now challenging how this redistricting scheme is undermining the power and the influence of the black vote. We also saw the premeditated attempt to change minority districts in county after county, like Pitt County and Duplin County and Guilford County. Last year, we also saw an attempt to pass voter ID. It was vetoed by Governor Beverly Perdue, the only Southern governor to do so. But it will happen again. They will try again. We also are seeing now plans to roll back same-day registration and Sunday voting and Saturday voting. We have the most progressive laws in North Carolina and the South that has made North Carolina the highest increase of voting participation since 2004 in this nation. And yet there is a premeditated attempt now to roll back same-day registration and early voting and Sunday voting. There's this attempt to push voter ID again. And in this state, that is a state that already has a stringent voter, a signature attestation law that says if you sign your name and you lie on voting on election on the vote, you get a 5-year felony. And this was a compromise some years ago by Republicans and Democrats. And yet, in a state with no evidence of voter fraud, there is this attempt, again, to pass voter ID. Now, we know that voter ID and changes in same-day registration and early voting would have to be pre-cleared because of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And if it wasn't for the pre-clearance of the Voting Rights Act, we would have no protection. We would have no recourse against these premeditated, deliberate acts to stop, to stifle, to steal, to segregate the power and the potential of the African-American and minority vote. That is why we must keep Section 5 alive. That is why our Attorney General in a southern state, Roy Cooper, has signed on to the brief saying we must keep Section 5 alive for the sake of progress and the sake of our democracy. One more fact, and then I'll conclude. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, and this is why, reporters, we ask you to pay very much attention to the historical continuity and context of these attacks. It was 25 years after the Voting Rights Act before North Carolina got its first African-American congressperson. In 1990, 25 years after the Voting Rights Act, and we've only had that person in place for 23 years. To suggest that 23 years of partial inclusion is the fulfillment of the promises of our democracy after hundreds of years of denial and discrimination is ridiculous, is wrong, is ludicrous, and we should keep the Voting Rights Act alive. Thank you so much, Wade.
Wow. Thank you, Reverend Barber. Calvin Henderson, a voter and NAACP president in Pitt County, North Carolina, will tell us about how Section 5 protected his community's right to vote in 2012. Calvin?
Thank you, Wade. Hello to everyone. My name is Calvin Henderson. Yes, I am a resident of Pitt County, located in North Carolina. Pitt County is about 100 miles east of Raleigh in eastern North Carolina. Our county is about 35% African American, and like a lot of the country, has been segregated in housing and schooling for many generations. Unemployment in Pitt County tends to be high. Our largest employer is a state college, East Carolina University and East Carolina School of Medicine. But we have strong community ties and take pride in family value and raising our families here. One of the biggest problems African Americans have in Pitt County is that elected officials in the county and the state have repeatedly tried to keep us from electing our candidates of choice. Just last year, the Department of Justice had to step in because the county attempted to make it harder for African Americans to elect candidates to our school board. The school board oversees about 35 schools in Pitt County. Two board members are elected from 6 districts, totaling 12 members. These are not paid positions. They are not plum positions held by political power players or kingmakers, but they are important to us because they oversee the schools that our children attend. Over the past 2 years, there was an effort in the state legislature to dramatically shrink the size of the school board, saying that it would streamline the governance. They would have cut it in half and would have added an at-large member to it. However, there has never been an African-American elected countywide to any office in Pitt County. And adding that at-large seat would have certainly had a retrogressive effect on our ability to elect our candidates of choice. They tried to do this even when they had option to shrink the school board that would not have been retrogressive. The local chamber of commerce offered a plan supported by the black community that would have made the board smaller. But just last year, the Department of Justice stepped in and objected to the plan. And today, Pitt County can still elect members to our Board of Education. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Calvin. Appreciate so much you joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, we're joined by Alabama State Senator Hank Sanders, a key organizer of the 2013 Freedom Rides for Voting Rights. Senator Sanders?
Yes, thank you so much. First, let me say that it is imperative that the public really know what's happening at this time, that we in danger of really losing the right to vote. That's why we are organizing Freedom Riders for Voting Rights. From Alabama itself, there will be buses leaving Selma, Birmingham, Montgomery, and I think also from Shelby County, going to Washington, D.C. to participate in the rally and press conference that will be held from there. They will then leave on the way back and stop in various cities, Charlotte, Richmond, Greenville, South Carolina, Atlanta, and come back and have press conferences again in Selma, Montgomery, Birmingham. That's one of the prongs of the Freedom Riders for Voting Rights. There's a second prong on the last day of the Selma to Montgomery March, which will be on March the 8th. There will be buses coming in from 9 of the 16 states with Freedom Riders for Voting Rights coming to participate in the last day of the Selma to Montgomery March. Let me quickly say from my own personal experience why it's so critical that we have Section 5, because if we don't have Section 5, we may as well not have the Voting Rights Act. Just to give you a sense of the atmosphere, just last year we had a referendum, and I went to vote, and my name wasn't on the poll, and I thought, well, this is just a clerical error. But whenever when we called the poll officials called the voting registrars, they refused to allow me to vote. I'm in the state senate for 30 years, but I voted at the same place since 1980. I've been on the ballot itself every 4 years since 1982. But I finally had to vote a challenge ballot. It was just an attitude to send a message, say, well, if he in the state senate and he can't vote, other folks know that they can't vote. It was that kind of attitude. I've also seen just recently in Enterprise, they didn't want to use the voting list to determine voting list. They wanted to use utility rolls to determine the voters. That's the kind of thing. They're trying to move voting places in the white churches to discourage black folks from being able to come. I saw in the Alabama legislature where they was simply trying to make sure that the only Democrats could be elected would be black Democrats, and that means they couldn't form any white partnerships with whites. That's what was passed in the Alabama legislature for redistricting in the House and the Senate. And one last little quick thing. This past year, in November, they had a referendum on the polls. I mean, a referendum to be voted on. And it looked good because it was about removing language from the Constitution about poll taxes and about separate schools for black and white. But upon closer examination, what we found it would do is remove the right to a public education. And this was a referendum. The problems are there. The attitude is as bad now as it ever been. In fact, it had been getting better up until the last few years, and now it's in fact getting worse, which will produce all kinds of problems if we don't have Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
Thank you, Senator Sanders, and thanks to all of our speakers today. Operator, I think we're now ready to take some questions from our reporters. All speakers on today's call are still on the line and available to answer your questions. Reverend Barbara, I know you have a schedule conflict and will have to leave soon. Lindy, if you would, open up the lines. Thank you.
And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may remove your question from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one keys now. We'll pause for just a moment to allow questions to enter the queue. Again, that's star and one if you would like to ask a question. And we'll take our first question from Mary Troyon with Montgomery Advisor. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, Senator Sanders. It's Mary Orndorff with the Montgomery Advertiser.
How are you doing today?
Good. How are you? How many people are you all expecting to get on the buses and be in D.C. for Wednesday's arguments?
We will expect nearly 200.
Oh, wow.
And they're
coming from Alabama, but also other states?
Nearly 200 from Alabama.
Oh, from Alabama.
Many more will be coming from other states.
I see.
And Brother Wade, if I might, this is Reverend Barbara, we'd let the reporters know that we will be bringing persons from North Carolina. The NAACP is mobilizing college students that will be coming from colleges and the surrounding areas. In fact, the reporters may need to know that we were able to defeat, there were two cases. There was a LaRocque versus Holder case out of North Carolina that we were able to push back. And we stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters from Alabama because what's happening in Alabama, this case is not just about Alabama, but it will affect the whole nation. And that's why it's so powerful that we stand together. And the last thing I'd like to say before I get off is my brother from Alabama raised a critical question that media should understand. The Voting Rights Act is not just about electing African Americans, but allowing African Americans to build the kind of fusion politics to elect candidates of their choice. And fusion politics has always pushed this democracy forward. And that's why it's so scary, and people who have this homogeneous view of politics are so afraid of it, because fusion politics allows us to imagine new forms of power and new ways of promoting the ideas of our democracy. And this is no time to undermine that. And that's why people are coming from state after state. We're bringing vans and students from North Carolina as well as other persons, because we must stand together. This attack on Voting Rights Act, Section 5, is fundamentally an attack on American democracy.
Senator Sanders, could you talk about redistricting, just like the Reverend mentioned? I mean, what do you think would happen in Montgomery without Section 5 specifically regarding redistricting?
Well, right now what they have done is created districts that will simply be virtually have eight black districts and everything else would be strictly Republican district.
Uh-huh.
I have no doubt in my mind that if we don't have Section 5, then these eight black districts will also disappear in the very near future. I have no doubt in my mind that the one congressional district will African-American majority district will disappear in the near future. The attitude that African-Americans ought not to really have the right to vote is still lurking out there. And if we don't have Section 5, in my opinion, then the right will diminish greatly and soon disappear.
Isn't there, though, the white Republicans in Alabama also gain from, and this is a point brought up earlier by one of the other speakers, that their districts become more Republican when they create a majority-minority district like Congresswoman Sewell's, then the other seven districts become more conservative and more Republican. So it's in some ways, it's in their interest to do that, right?
But what they also did was in the congressional district, there were two districts that had a substantial amount of 30% or more of African Americans, which means that they could join together with other people and elect a candidate that represented a fusion of interests and ideas.
Uh-huh.
But they cut those down well below that, so you can't have that impact. And your question is, of course, that somehow you don't think that this will happen because of that. In my opinion, the feeling is such until we just will not have any majority African-American district. And they can still reconfigure districts in a way until Republicans will not only have a majority, but may very well have every seat in the Alabama legislature.
Mary, that's an important question. Let me ask Ryan Haygood of the Legal Defense Fund to also offer a response. Ryan?
Sure. Thanks, Wade. And there's a really important point to pick up on Senator Sanders' point and Reverend Barber's point, which is that, you know, what we've seen in the Section 5 context, particularly given the changing demographics in this country, is that where African Americans and other people of color are poised to become a majority of an area, and therefore influence with their votes the outcome of the electorate, it's precisely at the time they're on the verge of exercising their political power, often for the first time, that efforts are made to thwart or dilute that voting power. So the very frightening example, frankly, that comes from the record from Kilmichael, Mississippi, where the 2000 census showed that black voters, for the first time, had become a majority of the city, and could, for the first time, elect their preferred candidate of choice. Now, in the city of Kilmichael, the city council had always been white, as had been the mayor. There were five city council members and a white mayor. And the African-American population had become a majority, which made it seem like they could, for the first time, elect their preferred candidate of choice. So what the good folks in Kilmichael, Mississippi, did, rather than have an election, is they simply canceled the election. Now, that is, of course, a voting change, the subject of Section 5's preclearance provision. The Department of Justice rejected that proposed voting change, which was actually a cancellation. The election went forward, and the outcome was that African-American voters cast their votes in a way that led to the election of three African-American city councilmen and an African-American mayor for the first time.
Mm.
So there is this important point to be made about the way that the changing demographics influence states that are covered by Section 5 to exercise ways to dilute voting strength or deny minority voting strength.
Exactly. And this is Reverend Barber, Dr. Barber. Because the South particularly is no longer solid, and the demographics are changing that. And as I noted, if you run the historical line of efforts to reconstruct this nation, you find that at every attempt to move us forward, whether in the 19th century, the 20th century, now the 21st century, there is this fundamental attack always at first reveals itself in voting rights. For instance, in North Carolina, we had 70.2% of African Americans to vote in the last election. 54% of them voted at same day registration or early voting. So what do we see? We see an attempt now to want to roll back same day registration and early voting, and the only thing that keeps them from doing that is the fact that a preclearance. And the fears about that. If voter ID is passed in North Carolina, it would have disallowed 600,000 people from being able to vote in the past election. in redistricting. We've seen 52% of African Americans stack packed into three congressional districts, which meant in North Carolina, for instance, we went from having an almost even split of Democrats and Republicans in the United States House of Representatives to now having only three, and two of those being African American because of the way the black vote was segregated and isolated. So what we see is if you can't stop the vote and you can't use blatant Jim Crow, now we have this James Crow Esquire. And members of the media should know that when they do these redistricting, the only data they have is race. They don't have party and they don't have income. They have race. And we have seen them actually use maps where houses are split down the middle so that the people live in the front side of the house go to one precinct and the other go to the another precinct. Clear evidence of discriminatory redistricting and gerrymandering attempts to stop the power and the potential of not only the black vote, but the power and the potential of black vote to build fusions with white and other minorities and other demographics to, in fact, change the American electorate. And that is wrong.
And I wanted to add one more example because it dovetails nicely with Reverend Barber's point. In the state of Texas in the last 10 years, the population exploded there by 4 million people. 90% of the growth of the 4 million people were black and Latino folks in Texas, which would have entitled the state to four additional seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. And folks know on this call that a three-judge federal court recently under Section 5 blocked parts of Texas's redistricting plan because it was enacted with discriminatory intent. Under Section 5, our democracy's discrimination checkpoint, parts of Texas's redistricting plan were blocked, and it turns out that they've been blocked ever since the state was first covered by the Voting Rights Act in 1975. But Texas wasn't done with just an intensely discriminatory redistricting plan. As folks know, Texas also sought to enact the most restrictive photo ID measure in the country. And the estimates there, similar to what Reverend Barber articulated in North Carolina, were on the order of 600,000 people didn't have the type of government-issued photo ID Texas was requiring. Better than 200,000 of them were black and Latino. And again, under Section 5, a three-judge federal court, followed by the Department of Justice, rejected that proposed change as discriminatory and harmful to minority voters. So these are concrete ways in which Section 5 is doing important work, as Congress predicted when it recently reauthorized the Voting Rights Act in 2006.
Mary, thanks for your very good question. Gentlemen, thanks for your response. Lindy, we'll take the next call. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Carl Marshall, GBM News. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, and this question is directed to the panel. I'm interested in finding out the history of the case in the appellate court.
Ryan?
This case was filed by, I'll back up one step further and share that 2 years ago the Supreme Court considered a constitutional challenge out of Texas. The Supreme Court sidestepped the constitutional question and allowed the jurisdiction there at issue, which was a small utility district, to bail out from Section 5's coverage. And that case was largely originated by and funded by a conservative activist who was previously an entrepreneur, and he had directed his resources. Again, in this case, he approached Shelby County. His name is Ed Plum. He approached Shelby County and the county attorney in particular and explained that he would take on their case challenging the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act at no cost to the county. And what's fascinating about this case is that a good number of folks in the county weren't even aware that the case was filed on behalf of them, presumably. In the district court, we prevailed. The district court judge recognized that Section 5, and in Alabama in particular, was doing important work, and that was a ruling that was followed by the appeals court, three-judge panel, and that case had been appealed. Then after those two positive rulings in the district court, the Court of Appeals in D.C., now to the Supreme Court.
Thank you very much. Lindy, we'll take the next question, please.
And our next question comes from Aria Mitchell with Mid-South Tribune. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
How are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
Most of my questions have been answered, and I was going to ask a little bit more about this fusion politics. How do you think, in the South, what exactly would black people fuse to? Okay, and the second question I want to ask, is there a website?
Right.
Is there a website for the Selma marches that we can put
out? Those are both great questions. I'm going to ask Reverend Barbara to address the issue of fusion politics, since he mentioned it, and then I'm going to ask Senator Sanders to talk about the march, please.
Yes, when you look at after, in 1868, all across the South, the Southerners began to rewrite Constitution. And there was this fusion between Lincoln Republicans, not the current day manifestation, but Lincoln Republicans, black and white, who joined together and fused their political strength. Many state legislatures either were controlled by African Americans or had such strong coalitions that they could join together with other progressive whites to redo and reconstruct the South. That's how the South was reconstructed. And from 1868 to 1872. And in 1872, there was a violent, vicious backlash. A group called themselves the Redeemers, and their primary goal was to redeem America from the influence of black and white fusion politics that they believed was taking America backward, when in fact the fusionists were trying to move America forward, passing the most progressive voting rights, labor rights, educational rights, and laws of the 19th century. You see the same kind of fusion in the civil rights movement, blacks and whites, Jews and Catholics and Christians and all coming together, young people coming together, different races, different geographical areas, pushing America forward. Then you see in the election of President Obama, what you see is, we're not partisan, but just analyzing history, you see blacks and whites and labor and Latinos and people of all different groups coming together. And you see, particularly, for instance, in the South, like in North Carolina, you see a different kind of electoral outcome that represents a new kind of fusion in the South that breaks the so-called solid South. And when you look at the demographics in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, North Carolina, you see the potentiality for that continuing fusion to break open the solid South, where you no longer will be able to say the South will operate in one way or another.
Reverend Barbara, this is Wade Henderson. Yeah. Let me just add to that for one moment, if I might, which is that the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights was founded as a coalition, a multiracial, multidimensional coalition of organizations and individuals committed to advancing civil and human rights. We've always believed that in coalition there is strength, and we have long known that to enact any law in Congress or at the state and local legislature, you need a multiplicity of voters. You need voters from every community to offer real strength. If you're not practicing coalition politics, you're not practicing the politics to win in the 21st century. I think the question was an important one.
Wait, may I make one point? I just want to real quickly. And in North Carolina, when we brought together 140 different organizations of all different races, that's how we won same-day registration and early voting in 2006, which has fundamentally changed politics in North Carolina and can change it in the South. And if it wasn't for preclearance of the Voting Rights Act, everything we won, the same-day registration, early voting, Sunday voting, would be able to be annulled without any recourse from those of us in the South. Thank you, Wade.
Let me quickly add something. In the Alabama Senate, up until 2010, there were 8 African Americans, and there was 27 white Americans. However, there was 21 Democrats and there was 14 Republicans. The white Democrats and black Democrats worked together, and as a result, African Americans chaired 8 committees in the Senate. Now African Americans chair not a single committee. So there was this working together where whites, while they had many posts and had more posts, African Americans were in position of influence. Without fusion politics, African Americans are now being in the position of having no influence.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for those responses. And the caller asked to learn more about the march. And let me direct you to our website at www.protectthevra.org. That's www.protectthevra, all one word, .org. Thank you. Next question, Wendy.
And it appears we have no further questions at this time.
Well, I want to thank our speakers again this morning for joining us.
Could I just add one quick thing?
Of course.
I failed to mention that Alabama passed a very restrictive photo ID law, but they didn't submit it to the Justice Department because they didn't want it to be considered. So it's still hanging out there and have not been submitted, even though it's been passed almost 2 years. I just wanted to point that out.
Oh, that's an important factor, Senator Sanders, and thank you for pointing it out. And to our reporter friends on the line, I just want to say this is, I really appreciate, we all appreciate your being here this morning. You know, voting really is the language of democracy. If you don't vote, you don't count. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is an essential protection of American democracy, and thanks so much for reporting on this call.